This is episode 206, recorded May 5th, 2014.
Greetings, Aquarimaxers, one and all.
Hello, and before we go on, today is May 5th, but yesterday was May the 4th. It was May the 4th.
Be with you.
Yes, which is almost May the fish.
That's true, and today is May the 5th. Be with you.
So, yes, so today is Revenge of the 5th.
Okay. Okay. And if you don't get that, it's a Star Wars
it's
joke.
It's just Star Wars puns.
Yes.
Or Star Wars lisps, I suppose.
Yeah, something like that.
Yes.
So today, we have two contributors.
Mick.
In the one and only Carnforth, UK.
And Elliot.
In
California.
Yeah. Near Sacramento.
Sacramento.
Yeah.
So, Mick has kind of some cool stuff to say. They just went on a trip to Norway.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And they sent us some pictures.
Yeah, from his trip. Norway is beautiful.
It was beautiful. And his little girl's so big now.
Wow, yes, very true.
That's crazy. And I'm excited about this. Mick is sending us a mint cake.
From Kendall, where
yes,
he works.
Yes, a Kendall mint cake.
Remember the shop, Fangs and Fins? That's where it is, in Kendall, UK, near Carnforth.
So, that's awesome.
It is awesome.
I'm excited.
Thank you, Mick.
Yeah. He also has some fishy stuff to say. He says, I decided that I would thin out my axolotl group as one of the filters on a larger tank died. Oh. And I took three up to the shop and all three sold within a week. That's good.
Yeah.
So I am happy that I have brought a little axolotl love to the Kendall area.
How much do axolotls go for in your shop? Just wondering.
I don't know.
I saw some when we were down at Animal Arc a month or two ago. They were like $40.
Each?
Yeah.
Wow. What's that in pounds?
I don't know. I don't know what the exchange rate is right now. But a pound is more than $1, definitely. It's, you know, a pound's worth a lot more than a dollar, but I don't know.
When I went like a million years ago, it was like $1.70 to 1 pound. I have no idea what it is now, but I'm sure it's... Pounds are generally worth more than dollars.
Yes, definitely. But I don't know what the exchange rate is now, so I don't want to embarrass myself by saying something that I don't
know. Oh, come on, just make it up.
No, I don't like to do that. Okay. But anyway, I think that's cool that they're popular and they're selling out of his shop. Sounds like his shop's doing well, too.
That is a good thing. He says, I unfortunately lost my young axes from the spawn I had after about 2 weeks of hatching. They all died off over a period of about a week. That's a bummer.
It's very sad.
Though they seem to respond to the Walter worms, I wonder if brine shrimp might have been a better rearing food. They did this twice, as I had two spawns. Any thoughts?
Okay, well, I do have a few thoughts about that.
Tell me your few thoughts.
Okay, well, I have more than a few, I guess.
About this specific thing.
About this specific thing, I have more than a few.
Okay, tell me all of your many and sundry thoughts.
Well, and I did send... I sent Mick an email about this a bit already. First of all, we know that they were eating the Walter worms. He mentioned that and he sent us a video and we got to see them eating the Walter worms. So we know they're not having a problem with accepting them, and he just said that in his email. They're eating
them. They ate them quite
happily. And that's good. A couple of things to think about. One is, well, a lot of... And I know Mick is no stranger to using baby brine shrimp, and that probably is a good idea. I would agree with his idea that eating baby brine shrimp would be good for them. With our last betta spawn, we used baby brine shrimp and Walter worms, and we alternated them. And that seemed to work quite well. We'd give one feeding of brine shrimp and one feeding of Walter worms and one feeding of brine shrimp, one feeding of Walter worms, or approximately something like that.
A little bit more variety?
Yeah. And that's typically good, too. But one thing is... I asked him what medium he was using, and because that might have an effect. You know, some Walter worm and other nematode users, that sounds kind of bad,
nematode users.
I mean,
no,
people,
no, no. That needs to be a t-shirt.
I'm a nematode user?
Yes, yes. You could like order it custom and it would say, hi, my name is, you know what, if they custom order it with their name on it, and I'm a nematode user.
And then people will ask you what that is.
Yes, right? And then they can tell them what it is and it will be funny.
It'll be a good way to introduce them to the hobby, or maybe a really bad way to introduce them to the hobby. But it would be a way nonetheless, wouldn't it? But it would be kind of funny. But anyway, people who use nematodes like Walter worms, microworms, banana worms, and so on to feed to fish, baby fish. Okay. There is a lot of argument out there on the internet about whether or not feeding them specific foods, if those nutrients are then passed on to the fish.
Feeding the worms?
Feeding the worms. Foods? Say you feed the worms food A as opposed to food B. Food B has a higher nutrient value than food A.
So they're saying it depends on what you gut load them with,
food
basically?
B, sort of. It, some people are saying it doesn't matter. And other people say it does.
Some people also think that the nutrition in your food doesn't matter. They are nuts.
Well, I'll tell you what. And I'm not saying at all that Mick thinks that. I'm just saying, you know, this is a debate that's out there. That people will say, oh, I don't believe that I should ever gut load my microworms or Walter worms because I don't think it makes any difference. Okay. This is the thing. I have done some research on the area, not specific to myself. I mean, I haven't done original research on the topic, but I have researched the topic because it's an interesting one to me. And there are several academic papers, you know, peer-reviewed journals, mm-hmm. in peer-reviewed journals that they provide evidence that, you know, the nutritional profile of the food increases the nutritional profile of the worms themselves, which is then passed on to the fish that eat them.
That would make sense.
And I will put some citations to those if anybody's interested in looking at those on the website. But, you know, with that in mind, that's something that I've been interested in for a long time, something I've been doing for a long time. So
what do people suggest that you feed the Walter worms or microworms or whatever?
Personally, I've experimented with a lot of different things to feed the worms, but my most recent recipe that I like to play with is add some nutritional yeast, which is also called
brewer's yeast.
Mm-hmm. It's tastes essentially good on the
toast,
same thing.
Butter toast with that on it tastes good. I'm not even a microworm.
I kind of like it too, but it's nutritional yeast or brewer's yeast are essentially the same thing. Although I guess nutritional yeast sometimes has B vitamins added to it in addition to, you know, the mm-hmm. natural B vitamins that it's rich in. But anyway, I add a bit of that. Like every time I make a microworm culture, I'll add like a teaspoon mm-hmm. to it, and I also add spirulina. And those add a lot of protein, but also various other nutrients when you put all those together, and I seem to notice a difference in my fish. I haven't done any empirical studies, but I have done so. I have noticed a difference on the anecdotal level, and I think it helps. And I just suggested to Mick that he might try sprinkling a bit of those two substances on his bread, because he uses bread for his microworm cultures, mm-hmm. which it's a widely...
See, it's good on toast.
There you go. It's a widely accepted practice.
It tastes good on popcorn, too, but I don't know if the worms eat popcorn.
I don't know
so.
If they eat popcorn or not either. But it does seem to help, and I suggested that maybe Mick could try using some brine shrimp as he was thinking, and maybe when he does use Walter worms to boost them mm-hmm. with those, boost their
just
nutrient values with those.
So they get a little extra.
Right, and as they get bigger, maybe using some Moina and Daphne if he can get them, and some scuds. I think he cultures scuds mm-hmm. When the axolotls get a little bigger. And once they reach a certain size, now I haven't raised them, of course, but I have raised and kept their close relatives, same genus, the Ambystoma tigrinum, in the larval and non-larval stages.
Okay, that is a sentence right there.
Is it? Sorry.
Yes. No, you don't have to apologize. Okay. Just, that's a sentence with lots of words in it.
Okay, sorry. Did I waffle on there a bit?
No. I'm trying to express that it's cool.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. they will eat non-living food, and I imagine at some point the larva will start taking non-living food, and you can use, you know, fish pellets and so on with that. But until they do, those are some suggestions. Let's see how that might help. You know, I hope. have good luck with that. Because, yeah. I mean, baby axolotls, how
They're
fun
so
is that?
They're so cute.
They are.
I want axolotls someday. Gwenny totally wants axolotls.
I know. As soon as we get in a place that doesn't get this hot in the summer, we can try that out.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I really hope that helps, Mick.
Sorry. Non sequitur just popped into my head. Okay. Did you tell them that we fixed the field recorder and that's what we're using right now?
This is the field recorder.
This is the field recorder.
Hopefully you can tell the difference. Yeah, I called the company and they had an embarrassingly easy fix for me.
You know what? It's okay that it was embarrassing because it was easy
and it was also free.
Fast and it was free.
I just had pushed some wrong button by accident, not noticing that I had done so. And now I feel really goofy, but I feel happy that it worked.
So it was like the try restarting it again. It wasn't restarting it, but...
It wasn't. But I'm the guy that people come to when they have gadget issues. And I felt so dumb.
But you know, sometimes it's your own gadget and you panic because you're like, it can't break.
It's true.
And so you forget the easy fixes because you're panicked.
Yes.
So
I feel silly, but now we're okay.
So yay, hooray for easy things.
Thank you, Mick. And I was amazed by the green of Norway. And
oh,
I hope
beautiful.
To be amazed by the pictures of your healthy axolotls.
Yes.
We are setting something up. If it's going to work, we're going to try to set up an interview with Mick pretty soon.
Yay!
He's receptive to the idea, and we're going to try to do it. We can
extol the virtues of mint cake.
We're just going to make sure all the technology is sorted, and then we'll get it going.
Okay. Is he going to show us? Is it like a video one or an audio one?
That's what we're trying to get sorted.
Because I think it would be awesome to take a tour of his spiffy shop.
I totally agree, but we're going to have to get that all worked out first.
Yeah.
But we could interview Mick on all sorts of topics. And so we don't have to confine it to one interview.
It's true.
We've already done one, and we could probably do 16 more and not have to even worry about it. Trying to think about what we're going to interview, because there's that many things we could easily just talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yay, that's exciting.
It is. Okay. So thank you, Mick. And now we have Elliot.
Elliot from Sacramento, California.
Right.
And he messaged us on Facebook. He says, I was listening to podcast 205, and I think I have input to all three of the questions you threw out.
Yay! We love it when people respond to our questions.
Okay, remind us our questions, or should we just go through the...
Well, I think one was about how lighting affects fish color and what colors of lights to use and so on.
Okay.
And the other one was, we were talking about the freshwater refugium with Anne in Pittsburgh and her red cherry shrimp living in it and whether that was a feasible idea. And then the last one was about the dry start method, where you put aquatic plants in a tank, but you just keep the humidity high in the tank fairly and you keep it kind of damp, but you don't have standing
water
past the substrate. Yeah.
Oh,
and so they can grow based on the high CO2 in the atmosphere and, you know, they're not competing with algae.
Okay.
And then once they grow in, then you put water in and the plant's already there and, you know,
right,
they've had a good head start. So those are the three things that he's going to respond to.
Okay. So he says, I was putting off replying, thinking someone else more knowledgeable would do a better job. But when you hit all three topics, which I recently got into, I felt I should contribute. Buckle in for a long message. Okay,
fasten your seatbelts, ladies and gentlemen. This is going to be an exciting ride.
Exits are to your left and your right.
Please
over the wings.
Arms and legs in the vehicle at all times.
And if we experience a loss of cabin pressure, please secure your own oxygen mask
before assisting those around you.
Okay. Anyways, so we'll go through maybe kind of by subject, read his bits and talk about them. Okay.
Yep.
So he says, let's start with the lighting for fish color. I had a similar problem, but with the red coloration. After converting my saltwater aquarium into a discus setup, I realized the reds and yellows of a few of the discus weren't as nice in my tank as the imports.
As the importers.
Importers?
So the importers of the discus.
Okay.
They look nice,
like
the
pictures and stuff of the guy he got them from?
Like the tanks for the guy he got them from.
Okay.
Yeah.
At first, I thought it was the stress or condition of the fish, but after a few months of settling in, I concluded that it was the lighting, which was a reef-specific LED light. Without going too deep in the technical detail, LEDs emit a light which peaks at one wavelength and dramatically drops on either side in the spectrum. With that in mind, unless you can match the particular wavelength in NM, what's it?
Nanometers.
Nanometers. Unless you can match the particular wavelength LED as the fish you are trying to display, you will not get the true color of that fish. So he's saying if you don't have the exact same wavelength, that would reflect the exact same color of the fish?
Basically, yes.
Okay.
And by using broad spectrum of different colors of LEDs, you can often get some of that going on.
Because you've got so many different ones right, in there.
But since his was reef-specific to probably the wavelength was optimized for a growing photosynthetic organism.
And not for showing off colors.
And not for throwing off discus colors, right? Okay. It might show off specific colors of other creatures, but not discus.
Okay. Oh, I gotta find my place now.
To give you an example. Okay.
To give you an example, my pair of Ocellaris clownfish, think Nemo coloration, looks black and white under just the blue or actinic LEDs. So the orange and white fish under the actinic LEDs look black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Adding blue or actinic lighting is definitely a solution to the lack of blue in fish problem, and in fact is very good for the plants, as it is usually the wavelength required for chlorophyll activation. And he says roughly 420 to 520 nanometers, but don't quote me.
Okay, we just did. Sorry.
That's okay. He just means don't put money on it.
Okay.
Yes. Meaning more useful light for photosynthesis or higher PAR. And what's PAR?
Photosynthetically available radiation.
That's a good phrase.
It is.
Could be like an album name.
A really long album name.
Yeah. Well, you just call it PAR.
Yeah, that's true.
And they're in like golf outfits. Anyways, okay. This can be seen in the grow lights used for plants, and most prominent those who grow recreational herbs. Oh, how about that? They have a blue or purple hue to it. Interesting. However, I find that these unnatural colors in the high Kelvin spectrum, cool white, etc., washes out the green color in a planted tank, which is what you want to display. So, on one hand, you get good growth, but aesthetic-wise, not so much. With me still? Is that a rhetorical question?
I'm with him, you're with him,
you're,
right?
You're with him.
And you're with him.
I'm working on it.
Okay.
No, I think I'm okay. So, back to my situation. My options at first was to go with a full-spectrum LED, which... with a full-spectrum LED setup, which emits the entire visible spectrum and then some, but the cost for those are out of my price range. So I looked into other options, full-spectrum metal halide bulbs, or T5 bulbs, since I live in California. I could pass for the extra heat metal halides put into the tank. So I went with T5, and now my discus looks amazing. Oh, are metal halide bulbs and T5 bulbs not the same thing?
Not the same thing.
So he doesn't mean or as in this is also what they're called. He means right. Ors and these are two T5s different options. T5s
are very narrow, high-output, high-efficiency fluorescent bulbs.
Okay.
Metal halide is a totally different technology.
And they make a lot of heat, want a lot of heat.
Yeah, they run hot, so he didn't want it.
Okay. So he went with the T5, and it's working nicely on his discus.
Mm-hmm.
It says, also, just to note, I don't think the marine land LED the contributor is referring to is submersible. A recognized brand in the salt water called Tunze, T-U-N-Z-E, does have a pretty decent submersible LED. More information can be found on their site. Searching Tunze submersible LED would bring you to it. Just a quick disclaimer, I am not a qualified aquarium lighting expert. The information I provide is from my own research and experience, so please take it with a grain of salt. How do you get to be, like, an official qualified aquarium lighting expert? Do they have a degree for that?
I don't know.
You work for the lighting companies?
I don't know if I don't think I'm a qualified aquarium lighting expert either, but, you know, just there's different levels of experience. You go in different directions and you learn about it, I guess. I don't know. Now, that is possible that I was thinking of the wrong kind of bulb when I assumed they were talking about the submersible, and maybe they weren't. So, yeah, thank you for bringing that up. And that, I think, helps clarify things a lot for Anne in Pittsburgh. I hope it does. I think that some good information. So, thank you.
That's good.
Thank you for sending that in, Elliot. And now let's move on to the next one.
Yes, he says, next for the freshwater refugium. As I said, I converted my saltwater setup to discus. I kept my three-chamber sump setup. In the first chamber, I have the heaters and Java moss tumbling from the input from the main display, thinking it would be a good nutrient export. But as it was addressed a few podcasts ago that Java moss don't really grow in 30 degrees Celsius water, that plan was flawed. I found that the moss is a magnet for detritus, so I use it as a catch and rinse it out every time I do water changes. I have since added a filter sock to the inlet to do a better job and just left the Java moss there. The water then flows over some baffles into a second chamber, which is the refugium, lit up by a small fluorescent light with a few fast-growing plants to take up nutrients. The plan was to make this chamber long enough and the flow rate low enough for the suspended particles to settle. At least that's what the idea was. The setup works well, but I find that waste buildup was high here, and having soil substrate made it difficult to siphon and keep clean. So a tip is to put the plants in pots. This way you can still siphon and yet have the benefit of nutrient export. That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm, it is.
I have a colony of red cherry shrimp here. They do wonders cleaning up dying matter from the plants and also any waste food that makes its way down into the sump.
So this also ties right into what Ann in Pittsburgh was asking about.
The waste problem is solved by the potted plant method. The ones that fall in the potted soil is local to the plants and can be taken up easily. The ones that fall outside the pots is siphoned up every time I do a water change. The shrimp population is stable enough that I don't pay attention to the shrimps when I siphon and most likely take out about 5 to 10 shrimps every time accidentally, I promise. To make myself feel better, I consider it culling the weak ones that don't have the strength to swim away.
It can be hard when you have a tank full of shrimp to siphon without catching some. I know how that is.
Occasionally you get one or two diced up shrimp in the main display, which becomes food for the discus. The problem with this refugium setup is that because I feed my discus heavily, the plants grow fast and I have to prune the plants back dramatically every 2 weeks, which becomes a hassle. The last chamber is set up with K1 Kaldness media. K-A-L-D-N-E-S. Do you know what that is?
I'm not familiar with that one, no.
He says, I teed off on the return pump to put more flow into tumbling the media as the biological filter. And what is teed off? Okay,
I think what he's referring to is when you have a T-shaped pipe so that it goes both directions.
Okay, so it's flowing out of both sides.
Mm-hmm.
This sump setup is designed around removing as much suspended material from the water first before reaching the biological filtration so nothing builds up and decays in the last chamber, and because it's a tumbling media, it keeps its bacteria culture new as well. Plus, the setup is pretty cool when you see it, with two materials tumbling on either end, which is always a talking point. I have a picture which would make what I described a lot more sense. I have an issue, though, with the refugium. I am finding that I have an outbreak of ram's horn snails in the refugium. So far, they have been confined to the second chamber, but I would like a control for them before they spread. What is a good choice to control pest snails yet not disrupt my system and is compatible with discus conditions?
One assassin snail.
Uno.
Yep, just one. That would be enough. They do fine in warmer water. As far as I can recall, I've had them in pretty warm water, in the 80s anyway, and they do fine. And you'd only need one, and it would take care of everything, I'm pretty sure.
One would eat them all?
Mm-hmm, eventually. I mean, if you've got them in different compartments chambers. Or chambers, then you might want to alternate the chambers that it lives in. You know, we might put it from one to the other, but it would eventually take care of them. Yep.
I'm curious. Just size-wise only one, or... Like, you just don't need more than one to take care of the ram's horn snails?
Well, I would say... assassin snails don't breed very quickly. But you really... I'd just say to keep it easy and not have to worry about dealing with other assassin snails and trying to feed them once they eat all of the snails, you know, and you have a growing population of them, which doesn't grow very quickly, I grant you, but it's if you put two or three in there, you'll probably get more of them, and then you'll have six of them, and you'll have no snails anymore, and now what are you going to do? But if you just put one in there, it should take care of them.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't disrupt the system at all, especially the system the way he's got it set up. We did look at the picture, by the way, because he posted them.
Yes, they are. Yeah. So he posted them to the Facebook. Can cool other setup. People get to it since he sent it as a message? Do we need to move them?
I don't know, but I will look into different options for people being able to see that.
Okay.
So that people can check it out. If it's not on our Facebook page, I'll make sure it goes somewhere else that you can see it, like on the show page or something.
Okay.
Because it's a cool setup. I really like it. And I can imagine what the tumbling looks like just looking at the picture. And I think it's a really cool setup, and I think it really helps Anne with her question. Now, the fact that she's got the medium on the bottom, she's got the little ceramic tubes, there will be some modification maybe she might want to make if she's going to get a setup similar to his. But at the same time, the idea of the plants in the pots and how the waste that falls down from the shrimp themselves into the pots is going to be dealt with by the plants, and whatever falls around them, you can just siphon out. That's a handy way to do it. I like that. Yeah. So.
It's nice.
Yeah.
Okay, lastly, for the dry start method. I recently planted dwarf baby tears to a small cube aquarium, which I plan to bring to the office with me once it is stable and settled. And so far, it has worked really well for me. I decided to give it a go after seeing this tank journal of a guy who did the same thing and had successes and failure. It's a good read, and he's puts the link on there, so we'll put that up for you guys.
Which we will put, yes. Mm-hmm. It's from redcherryshrimp.net, but it's a longer web address than right. that, so we'll put the direct link on the show page.
I only have experience with dwarf baby tears and can't speak for other types of plants. I used ADA, aqua soil, and root tabs. I gave it a 10-hour photo period on a 10,000K light and left it alone. I have attached a few pictures to show the process. I decided on the dry start method for the same reasons as you mentioned, high CO2 levels and no competing algae issue. I too have read about the mold and mildew issue. I believe that is due to humidity levels inside the aquarium. Many threads I have read kept their humidity too high, leading to mildew. I used a sheet of shrink wrap over the aquarium and do very minimal misting. A personal observation I made is that the tanks usually have heavy condensation on the glass, or tanks that usually have heavy condensation on the glass often have mildew issues. Dwarf baby tears can be grown fine immersed, and so the puddle of water is not necessary. They do require moist conditions. Though in my setup, I find that the dwarf baby tears are higher up on the slope with access to the water only through capillary action in the soil tends to grow slower, which is to be expected. I'm not sure I read that sentence very coherently. I'm sorry.
Well, basically, he's saying that when the dwarf baby tears are higher on the slope of the substrate, the
water's all running downhill.
So there's not any water, not as much moisture in that area that they can access.
Oh, okay.
They're growing more slowly.
Okay.
Because the drainage over the top.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I've grown quite attached to the terrarium look and I'm contemplating if I should flood the tank or not. What is the smallest schooling fish available in the hobby? I'm thinking of something smaller than Endlers or some freshwater harlequin shrimp if I can get my hands on them.
Hmm. Well, you know what I would say? You should probably go for some of the micro rasboras.
How big are they?
They're tiny.
They're smaller than Endlers and guppies?
Yeah.
Wow.
They are. I would say that the adults... it depends on the species, you know. There are several out there. But a lot of them max out at less than an inch.
Wow.
And they're quite thin, too. So an Endlers, like a male Endlers, might be a little bit over an inch, and then it has tail.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then a female Endlers is a bit bigger than that. But some of these microrasboras just say tiny, tiny, tiny. So that would be an interesting
direction to go.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that those are at least competitors for the smallest schooling fish available in the hobby.
That sounds about right. Any other thoughts on this?
Let's see.
Because that's the end of his email.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I think that's about it then. Thank you. I think that should help. And so that's like a custom-made email for the three topics that Anne brought up and in Pittsburgh brought up.
Yeah,
and
that was
great.
Really nice. Thank you, Elliot.
We needed that. That was exactly what we needed to hear. And so, hopefully, everyone, you will have a lovely fishy week. Yes. We have had a lovely fishy week in that I trimmed back my 20-gallon high.
And you looked, can see
it
looks
so much nicer. It had this thick mat of Rotala Indica all over the top. And it was getting a little dim. It was just growing too crazy, and I didn't know where my scissors were. I misplaced my scissors, and everything, you know, was busy, and so I didn't get to it. And then I just cut it back, and now it looks so nice. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
You're enjoying it.
Yeah. And did we have any other fishy news? I think that was most of the fishy news, wasn't it?
Yes, I think so.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you to Mick in Carnforth and Elliot in Sacramento, and...
May the fish
be with you.
And may the fifth not have their revenge.